are interesting halakhic things that can happen when you're traveling, but I'm not trying to say halakha l'maaseh, and I would urge everyone to take whatever I say just as a beginning point and to take their shailas to their rabbanim to get final psak. So I wanted to, although it's almost vacation time, but it's also the 9 days, so I wanted to combine, at least in our initial halakha, something to do with both, because I think as much as people are yearning for their holidays, but there is a point that we're not quite there yet. We haven't invited to do. In fact, I heard a beautiful idea from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He said we can accomplish as much on Tisha B'Av, in the Avodah of Tisha B'Av, as we can in a different way as on the Avodah of Yom Kippur. Such an idea should make us really stop and think for a minute, because a lot of us are trying to, I suppose, make the 9 days go more quickly, and Tisha B'Av in particular, it's a difficult day, but if we realize how much is at stake and how much can be gained, so then maybe we'd have a different attitude. But anyway, the first halakha I want to speak to, which combines the two, is a very interesting idea, which is when we bench, so there's a din that we don't have knives on the table during the week. And what happens, the shayla was put to the poskim, if you're on a plane. So in a plane, they give you a plastic knife. Yes? So you would have thought, well, do me a favor, what am I going to do with a plastic knife? But if you look in the Mishnah Berurah, it says two reasons why we take the knives off the table. The one is because of Kli Barzel. We don't have a Kli Barzel, which is Mekatzer, person, Chas Shalom, which shortens a person's life. And the other one was a Maisa Shahaya, of a person who is so taken up with his thoughts about the Korban that he took the knife and he harmed himself, right? So according to the one reason, well, we say a plastic knife is not Kli Barzel. But on the other hand, we would say that that a person could harm themselves. So they put the shayla to the poskim, and it comes out of machlokes. The poskim argue whether you need to remove these knives or not. And but I just mentioned in passing that I was told, maybe I mentioned this before, there is a woman in town whose son, who's a man in his 30s or 40s, was made to me that when she benches and she gets to the chelik of the benching, talking about remembering the Beis HaMikdash, the Binyan Beis HaMikdash, she's moved to tears on a regular basis. So we shouldn't imagine that this is for earlier generations, no shyness to us. The idea of being moved by thinking of the Korban should be very real to us. And so the Negeah to plastic knives, that was that halacha. Now I have my own little ba'ora, which you can take it or leave it, which is after 9/11, so the airline companies went meshuggah with safety precautions. To the point probably where the knives that they're giving us are so harmless, you're lucky if you can cut your meat. So even the poskim who were asked 30 years ago, do you have to remove the knives? I wonder if nowadays, if they would be so, would be so machmir, because the whole design of the knife is to basically not be able to harm anyone. Anyway, that's just a small horror. So now, one of the interesting things about writing a sefer on vacation halachas, or I suppose on any subject, is people come up to you and they tell you some very strange events that happened to them. In this case, people, when they were traveling, they told me some interesting stories, funny things. So I thought I would begin with some of those stories, and we'll move on to some of the things that are more more standard. But one was, a fellow was on a flight to China. So flight to China is at least however long, maybe some tell me 12 hours, 18 hours, whatever. It's a long flight. It's a long time to be without food. So anyway, it comes time for the meal. He goes to the Chinese stewardess and he says to her in this easiest possible English, the straightest possible terms, please do not open the meal. Just put the meal in the oven, bring me the meal, and don't open the meal. So she speaks English, she understands him, and she says, yes, I understand you. Off she goes. 10 minutes later, she comes back and the meal is unwrapped. Presents him with the food. Now he's got a 12-hour flight, or whatever it is, 18-hour flight, however long it is to get to China, and he's now facing no food. I guess whatever he must say, if I'm right, the people should really bring with food because of these circumstances. These things happen all the time. Mistakes are not uncommon. But anyway, so now he says to her, what part of my instructions didn't you understand? I think I made it pretty clear. I didn't want you to unwrap the meal. How did you, you said you understood me. What was misunderstood over here? So she says, I did exactly what you said. I put the meal into our ovens, wrapped. I took it out, wrapped. But I'm a hostess. I can't present you food in plastic. So I've unwrapped it and I brought it to your seat, unwrapped. Ma'adinoi. What's the halakha now? Sorry? if it would have been cooked unwrapped, then it would have been, if it would have been cooked simultaneously with tray food, then, but this, she's claiming that's not what happened. She's saying, I did exactly what you said, wrapped, I took it out wrapped, and now I'm presenting it to you in a decent way, in a dignified way. You're business class, can't bring you plastic food. What will the other passengers think? What will you think? So the shaila was, can he eat it? So there are two problems here. The one, you could argue, is not as big a problem. That's Bosan Islam and I. It was a meat meal, and he hadn't been watching it. So you could say, because the Poskim say that if you have a meat meal in front of you, beautifully wrapped, everything was closed, and you open it all up, and then you realize you need to wash Natilas Yadayim, so you go to the bathroom and you come back, and you realize you've just left your meat meal next to your goyisha, whatever you call it, your neighbor there, watching over your meat, so is that a problem? And the Poskim said that, in that case, it's not a problem, because you're Yotze v'nichnas. The goy said, yes, you have no idea when you're coming back, and wouldn't say that we don't have to be chayshus, they switched the meat or did something else. In any event, in this case, I think it's a little bit worse, because this goyish stewardess has gone into her galley to cook the food. You really don't have any business walking in there. If you do, I mean, you could walk in there, but she might feel a certain security. This is our zone. Passengers don't normally come here. So you're not exactly a yotzi v'nichnas on your terms. It's not your seat, and you have no business checking her out. And also, you know, who says she has a fear that, well, what will you say to her? So she'll say, you know, I'll bring it to you in a minute. She'll come up with an excuse, whatever it is. She has no reason why not. So that's one point. So it could be there, you already have a problem. That it's not Yetzir v'nichnas, wasn't Solomon Ayin. But there's a different problem. She's not Naaman. Just because she tells you, I unwrapped it at this point and I didn't unwrap it just as you told me, it's very nice. But who says she has any Naamanus whatsoever as to what she did or didn't do? And Papashtis, the food was usur, and he said he didn't eat on his way to China. So I don't know why he didn't have anything else with him, but that was the Maisa. Maybe he had the pretzels for him, I don't know what they did. A similar story of Naamanus, where someone went to the fish shop, I think it may have been locally, and they said to the guy behind the fish counter there, and said, I see you have salmon, and I see you're cutting up the salmon, but tell me, whatever they had, a knife, which the wife was going to do shifshuf, the woman's going to do shifshuf on the part that she saw cut. But she asked the fellow, what about cutting the fish in half? How does that get cut? So he says, no problem, that gets cut in the factory or wherever, in the fish production area before it even gets it, and it's a place only for salmon. So it sounds good, if it's only for salmon, so that you don't have to do shifshuf, because what else is going on to the fish side? Salmon is going to more salmon. But so the shaila was asked, one of the local rabbanim says, you can't believe him. He says, and who says he even knows? Let's say he's trying to tell you in all honesty, he believes that there's this fantasy fish factory that cuts the way he'd like it to be cut. But, you know, he's a 20-year-old guy who's worked there for a week, and he tells you, or even he's a 60-year-old guy, who says that things didn't change? So you can't rely the words of the goyim just because they said it was done in a certain way. That it doesn't need shifshuf, and the Rav told the woman that she has to do shifshuf even on the parts that was cut in half. A couple of stories about hotels. The easy, sorry?
Washing it.
Why? You wash it, and at the same time, you're giving a gentle scrubbing to get off any fat or anything else that might be there. Say it again? You don't fish? Okay. Maybe we'll get a live demonstration one week, I don't know. Some interesting story about hotels. The easy story of a hotel, I say easy, it wasn't very geschmack, but people involved, they booked, what's becoming more and more common now are hotels with electronic doors, where they give you a key, and the key releases the door, but it's an all electric circuit, and on Shabbos this is a problem. And as far as I know, I've not yet heard any heterim how to do it and what to, I did hear, I don't want to repeat it in public, but I did hear a certain Rav who had a certain mahalach where he found a way around it. But I mean, aside from using blue tack or something where you're jamming the lock, which may be a solution as well. But more or less, you have a problem opening and closing the keys. The people didn't check before they went what kind of a door was it. Maybe they assumed it was an older hotel. They got there and they said the whole Shabbos, someone in the family had to stay in the room. There was no way for everybody to be out the room. Now, there is possibility to ask a Rav, if you could ask a Goy to open the door for you, but it's not a very convenient way to have a hotel room, and especially that hatra I heard was only as a one-off. You shouldn't plan your holiday with a hotel room like this. A lot of these things, if you're stuck in this matzav, so then you might be able to get ahead to it, but that's not the way to plan your holidays. So that was the easy story. Another story, a fella turns up in Vegas on Friday afternoon, and he is going to book into one of these very big hotels, and they say to you, yes, Mr., we'll make up a name, yes, Mr. Smith, we have your room ready. It's on the 35th floor. Now, I've walked on Shabbos up 21 flights. It's exhausting. So they put this fellow on the 35th floor. So up he goes, and he asks them, is there no other room? Is there no other room in this hotel? 35 floors. Said, we have no other rooms available. This is the room we booked for you. So he said he spent the entire Shabbos in the room. There was no TLS. He said he would have been so tired walking up and down these flights of stairs. So again, it's advanced planning, and people couldn't possibly avoid it. If you can't, you can't, but then I hope you have a nice room. Goyen lift didn't see any Rabbanim allow it for a variety of reasons. It's a bit long, but for example, they're electric eyes, and they're also the motors are often weight balanced. So people who think you get in with a lift with a goy, he's doing everything, it's not right. The mechanics are such that you are also, you're causing certain... Yeah, they're chilukim, but I didn't see any rabbanim who are making to get in a lift with a goy. If you want to ask your rabbanim, the person stuck in that situation, the more than welcome. I saw no hetter to do that. The other story was that the person booked in advance, a nice hotel room, and everything was okay in their tone, sort of up before Shabbos. And they didn't realize was on Shabbos, the only way out of the room was through a certain hallway. And the hallway had these a light sensor, right? So during the daylight hours, so maybe it wasn't going to be such a problem, but to go out for Friday night davening and to come back at time of Malava Malka or for Shalosh Shudas, they were going to be triggering this light. So again, they had booked a nice room for a five-star accommodation, but it ended up being a bit like a five-star prison, because they didn't take it into account in advance. How are they going to deal with these modern electric issues? And it gets more complicated when the sinks now have electric eyes. What are you going to do then? And if that's not bad enough for you, maybe this is a bit easier. Some of the houses, which you think, well, they're all definitely old houses. They're in the middle of the countryside. What could go wrong there? Some of them, they either have pumps to push the water around the house that are triggered as you turn the water on and off, or the basic kisei has a motor in it that grinds up whenever you use it. So every time you're effectively triggering, again, electric circuits, and these are all shinas that people, it's a bit awkward to ask the house owner, could you please describe to me the mechanics of your basic kisei? And they go, what kind of a sugar is this? I'm going to rent the house to you. But nevertheless, there I'm sure there are ways that you could find out. You could be a bit circumspect, how you describe it, what you want, and they'll tell you what you need to know. Two other interesting stories. First of all, the prayer rooms in typical airports. So I've asked some Rabbanim, and they say if they're really non-denominational prayer rooms, you can daven in them. And one of the Rabbanim said to me, not only can you daven them, you can even daven at the same time that other people are inspecting their carpets. Right? So you're there doing your avoda, and then, etc. And it's not considered a steer. And I didn't ask him what's going to be if they're doing other things. Let's say they pull out a getchka. And if they do this kind of thing, we're not going to ask them. But if they would do such a thing, would that be a problem? So at least the example I gave you said would be fine. And those are probably some of the more religious people that we live amongst, so that would be more typical. So I said, what about missionary material? You go into these rooms and they know who's coming in, they know Jews are coming in, so they leave. He said, there's no dinim, you can't go into a room with missionizing material. You'd be well advised to know that it's there and to keep away from it, tell your kids not to pick up stuff, but that doesn't make it a room which is also to use. Right. So he didn't seem to be bothered by that. Not missionary material and not to
it's hanging on the wall.
Oh, so that's gonna be more problem. This is why I said a non-denominational room. It's really meant for everybody. It's just gonna be a big white room, more or less. Right, with the facilities for hand washing or something else, but not much more than that. But a fellow told me that a prayer room in some other countries doesn't mean what we mean. He was traveling and he was in Istanbul and he went to the prayer room. He said the airport itself was Mole Pritzis. So he went for a place that he could daven where he would have the suitable atmosphere. So he sees the prayer room, he goes and expects to find the big white room, and said he walked into a mosque. He said everything was set out. This was not a multi-faith room. This was just a mosque. The directions towards Mecca and all the suitable materials, whatever they do there, everything was set up. So his shaila was, is he allowed to daven there? So they call it a prayer room, but what is it really? Seemingly not. So I asked the shaila, and I was told that he had a third option. Interesting, he had three options. He could daven in this room, which was very similar to a mosque. He could daven in the airport, which was similar to a swimming pool. And his third option was inside this room. The way they set it up, there's a shoe room. Now, for a room just for shoes, right? It's like a bowling alley. They have room where they put your shoes in, and you can stand there as well. So what he decided, he was going to daven in the shoe room. And as they came to get the shoes, they looked at the yid with talis and tefillin on, but they left him alone. He made it out alive to tell the story. Anyway, the Rav said he did exactly the right thing. To daven in a mokum pritzis, your brachas could be prapashtas, you can't make any brachas there. He said there was nowhere to look that it wasn't pritzis. Okay, maybe you could find some quiet place, but he felt he couldn't find. Even though maybe Mikra and Din, it would have been okay to daven in this prayer room, but if you had another choice, so Rav Eisberg said it's better to daven with the shoes, right? Assuming that the smell is not one that's ma'akiv davening, but it's better to daven with the shoes. Okay, another interesting story. A family member went to Switzerland, and Switzerland was a nice flat, and it was over the weekend of Shabbos, and I said to them, take with you the necessary things for these modern accommodations, for your refrigerator, take with you a really strong magnet, which Mr. Adams sells, if anybody wants a really unusually strong magnets. That's number one. And take with you a timer in case you can't find where to put the magnet. Because what do you need a magnet for? If you get to these new refrigerators, not like the old refrigerator, you unscrew the light. That was easy enough. You know, you weren't going to do much damage. Or you put tape over the little trigger there. Everything sorted out. You might leave a tape mark, but maybe you could scrape it off. Whatever it is, you're not going to do too much harm to the refrigerator. The new refrigerators, some of them have LED lights which are built into the machine, and they tell you, I've called up a manufacturer, he said, you will not be able to access it unless you are a professional, and if and it's not for you to change. It's not designed for the homeowner to change. You're supposed to leave these things alone for the next 20 years and enjoy your lights.
And it's upset the warranty.
Sorry, and if you do it, you could be damaging the machine and losing the warranty all in one go. So I said to this relative, take with you the magnet, because the magnet becomes, if you ever like the game of hot and cold, so finding where the trigger magnet is on the top of these refrigerators is like that game. You have to move around with your very strong magnet to find the point where they've hidden the magnet on the top, usually on the top of the machine, often on the front plate, but in some cases, it's behind the hinge. Now, I don't know who would think to look there, but one time I found the magnet behind the hinge on the top, And I happened not to have a strong enough magnet, and the problem was every time I closed the door, for a second the light flashed. That means I basically offset the magnet, but for a second it flashed as I opened and closed the door. So, and I wouldn't have thought to look for it, except that I just noticed it before Shabbos, and I was masuk because that called nichalei or not nichalei. Do I want that light? Do I not want the light? But it's not the sort of thing you want to be sorting out an hour before Shabbos. So anyway, they brought with the magnet and the timer, you think it's no way you can lose with the timer, right? Because no matter what kind of refrigerator they give you, it still runs on electricity as far as I know. So you put the timer in and then you set it to go off for an hour during mealtime and or an hour for the three meals, or if you want to do 15 minutes on, 15 minutes off, however you're going to do it, and the rest of the time just runs as normal. There's no snacks in between meals, but okay, so that's the compromise, and that way you can't lose. Turns out this was, they couldn't find where the magnet went, and the fridge was built in such a way that you couldn't pull it out to put the it was screwed in. You couldn't put the timer in. To start getting a screwdriver and to take apart their whole cabinets to put in the timer was getting, especially with women, there wasn't going to be the fee what was realistic. So what are they going to do now? They have all their Shabbos food. It's going to go off. So they had a very old style solution. They went down to the supermarket and they bought bags of ice. And they had, luckily for them, they sold ice in this place. They put the ice, they put all the food over Shabbos on ice. I don't suppose they had any ice cream because that wouldn't have made it. But whatever it was, so you see, there's a Yiddish expression which somebody, my Yiddish is not particularly good, can tell me the correct words, but in English it is, a Yid on a journey is a half a Yid. Anybody know the expression? Okay, but what's the meaning of the expression? It means you're so out of place, so disjointed from your normal ways of carrying out your Yiddishkeit that you often stuck with situations that are very, let's say, b'dieved, or you've never thought of and you've never dealt with. So a person has to come very well equipped and well thought out, and the best thing is to do a lot of research beforehand. I'll tell you one other interesting story which a rabbi told me. He said he took his class on an outing, and they told him bring ample water, so they did. On an outing, to bring a lot of water.
Yes.
Water in a water jug. So all the boys brought with their water, and then it turned out two things went wrong. Number one, the day was hotter than they expected, and number two, the point where they were going to refill their water bottles didn't exist. There was no water there, or they didn't get it right. So now they had a certain amount of water, but nobody was in danger, but there was just a certain amount of water. So they had the following shaila. Do they use the water for al netilas yadayim? Do they use the water for drinking? Or do they use the water for, one of the boys needs to excuse himself to wash his hands, say a sher yotzar? What's the priority with this water? And again, it's not a case of secundus nefashas, so anybody's in danger. It's obvious that you drink the water. So this was the shaila. And I said to him, good shaila, don't know, so I called up a Rav, and he said to me the following. He said, which I found quite interesting, priority number one is drinking. You don't take any chances with people having enough to drink. And if you need it, if there's a legitimate need for it, so then that makes it a situation, even though you've got the water right in front of you, that you don't have access to water for netilas yadayim. The dinim of netilas yadayim are, if you don't have access to water for 72 minutes journey or 18 minutes, depending on the circumstances, so then you don't have access to water, so then you can cover your hands with plastic bags or with gloves or whatever and eat like that. So even though you've got a bottle of water staring you in the face, that's called not having water. That was Kaddish number one. Kaddish number two was, he said, so then you do netilas yadayim, and the third priority says if you want to make a bracha shir yotzer, he says, because for that, you're allowed to wipe your hands on grass or on leaves or whatever it is. I'll just point out that some people think that wiping like this is sufficient, right? It's not really correct, because you've got to wipe in the same way that you would wash with water. That means you're supposed to get the leaves or the grass in between your fingers as well, right? It's not enough just to do the surface, the bottom surface and the top surface. You also have to go in between the fingers, wherever the water would go, to cover your hand. So that was another shaila, and he actually said to me, I should write a mini kuntras for rebbes who go on outings. He said, there's so many shailas. I had one which I don't know the answer to. So they went on an outing, a group of boys with the rebbe, and it could happen to a family as well. They got to a reservoir where they were planning to wash. The reservoir water was so dyed orange from the local stones that it was totally a different color than normal water. And they wanted to know, could they do netilas yadayim with it? So I had to speak. There's a Talmud Chacham in town writing a sefer on netilas yadayim in town, and I spoke to him about it. What would he say? And it wasn't straightforward. It wasn't obvious. So, sorry.
It's not dirty.
Yeah, it's not dirty. So it's nishtana. The mara has been nishtana in a way that it totally looks different. Is that what is the cause of it? Is it because of the stones? Because the water itself has gone through some process.
Is it drinkable, the water?
Oh, is it? He didn't tell me what it could be. Is it drinkable? I think it was drinkable. Someone else told me it's drinkable. I wrote in my safer about if the water isn't drinkable to a dog, right? So then you shouldn't do netilas yadayim, you should do tefilas yadayim. So my example was the ocean. So a guy came over to me and he said to me, you wrote in your book that dogs can't drink seawater? So I said, yeah. He said, I've got plenty of dogs. They love the sea water. So I don't know if his dogs are different, or I don't know what's with the sea. So you can figure it. Maybe seas are more or less salty in different places. I have no idea. But the examples I saw suggested that the sea is not fit for a dog to drink, and maybe his dogs are particularly, tough dogs, and they can handle it. I don't know what to say about it. But if a dog couldn't drink it, ask one of the goyim who's there walking the dog, would your dog drink from this water? See if the dog does drink, and then you'll know. But anyway, you always have a solution, and that is you can do tevilas yadayim. That means instead of using a keli, you dip your hands in like a mikveh. The problem is people think if the water's kosher for tevilas yadayim, they stick their hands in, they think, oh, I'll save my wife the trouble or my kids the trouble, and I'll fill up the keli and I'll carry it back for them to wash. And you can't do that. If the water is so salty or so unsuitable, a dog wouldn't drink it. You have to do it in the place where the water is. You can't carry it to other people. Okay, let's see how we're doing for time. Still have 16 minutes, great. So, so I wanted to quote, when I was writing the Sefer, I called up one of the Choshev Rabbanim in England, and I said to him, what should I include? So he said to me, a very nice Yesod, he said to me, what halacha should I include? So he didn't answer what halacha is. He said, make sure you tell people that when they go on holiday, their Yiddishkeit shouldn't go on holiday as well. That means the basic Yesod is whatever your standards are when you're in Manchester or wherever you live, you should try to maintain as close as you possibly can those standards. A classic example is you get on the flight and you're presented with a meal that says kosher, and you've never heard of this heksher before in your life, and you find another from Yid on the plane, you say, have you ever heard of this? He said, I've never heard of this, I've no idea who this is. So you say, well, you know, it's Mistama, it's reliable, but who says Mistama? So if you would go into one of the local, you go to Halperin's, you go to Haber's, wherever you go, and by accident something stopped there with a heksher that nobody knows what it is, I don't think you would take it home with you, right? So in the same way, when a person's on holiday, they should try to keep the standard.
The staff knows about Hekshavim.
Okay, but I'm saying, imagine nobody knows. Imagine you're in a matzav, you're, I don't know, wherever you are.
Now I'm speaking about the shops.
Anywhere. Any doesn't have to be shops. I mean, anywhere. Somebody presents you, somebody gives you a gift on Purim with a heksher that you've never seen. You don't know what it is. You don't know who gave it to you. No one to ask. And what do you do? So the answer is, you err on the side of caution. So what are you going to do now? You're on a flight for 10 hours, you don't have food. The answer is you should think of that beforehand. You should bring with food. You should bring with food because it's not at all uncommon that these things happen. And just before I start, I'd like to mention a very interesting thing about Hashkocha to do with the Sefer, which I was nana from very much. When you name a Sefer the Rukeach writes, you should try to include your name in the title of the Sefer. And I had heard that idea before. I wrote my Sefer called B'chol Derecha De'eyu, and I thought, I'd like to put my name in, but really, I can't figure out how to do it, so I'll just call it what I think is a good name. Right? So last week, someone called me, it's already been out for whatever, 2 months now, someone called me and said, did you ever do the Gematria, the name of your Sefer? So I said, no, I just picked it because I like the name. He said, it's 391. So that's interesting. He said, you know what the Gematria of Yeshua is? I said, no, he says 391. So I took it as a very geschmack thing that it worked out that way. Okay, so now I'll just mention some more halachas. Okay, this doesn't happen so commonly, but let's say you're going someplace, you're going to visit your brother-in-law somewhere else, and he has tefillin there, so you think, oh, I won't bring my tefillin with. So to rely on somebody else's tefillin, although you can borrow shul's talis, but tefillin is very problematic. The reason being that the kesher on the tefillin shel rosh very often is not suitable for you. It's not in the right place. And unless you happen to be the person who knows how to tie, untie and retie properly, then you're putting yourself in a matzav where you're relying on, you hope this person is the same, similar head size to you. Not advised.
So, you know when he last has it examined anyway.
Okay, let's say so you're Shemayim. Okay, all right, right here. Another nakuda is, and this is not meant to be telling anybody how to dress for davening, it's just the way the place can discuss it is wearing a hat and jacket. Let's say you're on holiday and you don't have a hat and jacket with you, right? So however it is that you normally dress, and there's a minyan starting and you don't have how you normally dress. So there's a machlokes in the place, which is better, whether to daven the way that you normally dress without the minyan, or to daven now with them in a way that it's not the covet that you give normally to davening, right? And it's a machlokes. So it should just impress upon us the idea that, again, we're on holiday, and it's not always easy to bring with the things that we, whatever, you don't have to have the same wool hat if you're on a hot holiday. You could find, you know, these new mesh hats that are cooler. But just the idea that whatever it is that you do to mechabit davening, it shouldn't go on vacation just because you're on vacation somewhere. Another point which I wrote about, which some people ask me, why did I include it, is about driving, safe driving. And the reason I wrote about it, because we all drive, many of the people in the room drive all year round, it's not that we drive more on holidays, but there are plenty of people who rent a second car. I know people who rent a second car and then let their 20-year-old or 21-year-old drive a second car to help to bring stuff to wherever they're going on holiday. So all of a sudden, these people who don't drive all year round, or maybe, let's say, a husband drives more and wife doesn't drive so much, or vice versa, and now you need both people driving. So I wrote about it because I think, Bifrat, it's a time when people do more driving every day, doing outings, can be an hour back and forth. And I just wanted to point out that, I'm not trying to be a spoil sport, but in my opinion, it's one of the closest places we come, Chas v'Shalom, to touching upon the Isurim of being a roidef in Lotirtsach that we ever will in our lives. Because most of us never touch a lethal weapon, right? I wouldn't say that to an American audience, because I once stayed in a rabbi's house in Baltimore, and he said to me, I have 6 guns in the house. I don't know why 1 gun wasn't enough. 6 guns in the house. I said, oh, and I know. And he said, all of my daughters know how to shoot. He said, it's no point to have guns in the house and people don't know how to shoot them. It makes them more dangerous. So anyway, I wouldn't say to an American audience closest to become to lethal objects, but for the English audience, when else are you going 70 miles an hour in a big piece of metal down the, and if a person is busy, I don't know, checking the text message, it's a funny bumper sticker which says, honk if you love God and text if you want to meet him. So, the idea that these are dangerous things, and although this is people, they try to portray it in advertising as a fun thing, you know, you've got a sunroof and you're going where you want to go and it's freedom and all. Okay, whatever the advertisers say, we're not interested. We want to know, as Yidden, we are achrai for a very dangerous thing, and all of the laws, even though people say, when does it apply, doesn't apply, but when it comes to safety matters, I saw this. Many posts in which say, it comes to safety matters, you have to follow the law of the land. And that could include, should include, obviously, chura, not to be texting, and not to be totally distracted, or if you're driving when you're exhausted. I heard 2 stories in the last 6 months of people, neighbors, who fell asleep at the wheel driving back, I think it was from London, and having nearly fatal accidents. They had nisim, nobody was hurt, but they said they were going full speed and they fell asleep at the wheel. Yeah, so it's not poshut. And Befrat, if you're going on some faraway holiday house, you're going to Devon. So that's a long, long drive. And if you leave it at the end of the drive, is going to be, and some of these roads have no light, so it's really, really boring. And you're driving along, and there's only so many Red Bulls you can have. And at a certain point, you just have to say, I just can't drive anymore. And that's your responsibility. The kids are going to moan at you, want to be there already. And, you know, you want to be there already. But the Maisa is a very dangerous matzav, and people should know that Adarabah, the Mekayim guarding Yiddish lives by taking the rest and planning the day in the first place, that they shouldn't be traveling when they're exhausted.
One should speak on a mobile phone while they're driving, even if it's not dinner to one foot, they should speak on
something. Okay, again, should do dangerous things. Okay, another example of this, I heard a story from one of my kids. They were in Switzerland and they had an amateur driver. I mean, it wasn't a professional driver of a big vehicle, 12 seats, 16 seats, and they were driving up and down mountain roads. And they said, well, we didn't order a big enough one, so just pile in. So they piled in an extra 5-6 people into this car with an amateur driver driving up and down mountain roads. So if I would have been there, I don't think I would have given my haskama for my child to get in the car. But people, okay, if it's a matter of person being stranded or it's a medical emergency or something, then you put extra people in. But to plan lechatchila to go places where you don't have enough seatbelts, you don't have the security things, and people are falling all over you while you're trying to drive, so for sure that is not the way to go about it. Another nakuda, which I think is more of a, it depends on your personality and whether you radiate, let's say, a certain kind of friendliness. Sometimes goyim, when they're sitting next to you on a flight or they're next to you on the train or you're going in an outing, and they see your tzitzis hanging out, and they'll ask, you know, why do you wear those strings? So, you know, you can answer them with a joke and say, I'm a balloon salesman and I had good business today. Yeah, but assuming you don't feel like making jokes, Someone told me he lived in New York and he would have these questions all the time. He just had one standard answer and he said he never got asked for it. He just said, we wear it for religious reasons, or it's a part of our religious tradition. And that's an answer that answers their question. And also, why am I being so reluctant? Because there are isurim about teaching, if you want to see Rav Moshe, he has a tshuva about it, about teaching teaching goyim Torah, that there's nothing to do with them. Okay, the Shiva Mitzvah's B'nai Noach, so maybe you could. And I say maybe, because not poshut, because you're not supposed to teach a Talmud Sheinu Hogun. And that includes goyim. Imagine you're teaching a goy. You imagine the reason why he wants to know is to try to make fun of Yiddishkeit, to make fun of the Torah, make fun of Hashem, whatever it is, so then you shouldn't be teaching him at all, even if it is the Shabbat Mitzvah. But you sit next to a goy, and just because he is curious, you have to be polite. You have to speak to him, there are cherets, but you don't actually have to give him any toichen. You don't have to answer his questions. In fact, you're touching on his surim if you do give him. So I once saw the tziv, I believe, says it's easier to teach Torah b'ksav than Torah shabal peh. So interestingly, if a goy would ask you why you're wearing tzitzis, it's easier to answer him according to the tziv than answer him why you're wearing a kapel. Even though we think a kapel is just a minog, but it's based on a gemara. Right, it's based on a gemara. We wear it for Yerushalayim. So if, once you start telling him that, you're already getting into Torah shabal peh. Where tzitzis, you can say, if according to the tziv anyway, you can say, I wear them in order to remind myself of my obligations to Hashem, because that's more or less their, for their level, suitable translation of the pasuk, right? But nevertheless, that's not poshut to be teaching goyim if they just because they ask you a question. And the other thing is even teaching yidden. If you're teaching a yid who you see is rebellious and is anti, so again, it's not so poshut. Although we'd like to think we're being makar of them, but you need advice. Really, it's a shaila for Das Torah, under what circumstances, because every conversation you have with them, you may win 2 points, but after listening to them talking, you've lost 8 points. In other words, once they filled your head with so much kfira, what they think, what they believe, so who says you have to fill your head with their shtusim in order to makar of them? Right? I'm not trying to pass an oath, I'm just saying, make a cheshbon. I wouldn't let my kids, for example, teenagers to go out and try to be makar of people because they're going to get so many deyas, so many krim ideas from people. So who says that justifies the damage to them, the helping of other people? If they're erlich and they want to know and they come to you for Shabbos meal, they've come to you to learn, it's totally different. But just strangers on the street, so you have to weigh up the pluses and the minuses. Okay, we have about 1 or 2 minutes left. Another one is taking packages. We all remember the story, I imagine, of the boys who went to Japan and were used to carry things that were illegal and the serious matzav that created. So even though there's a gewaltige chesed, mitzvah chesed, to help people to carry things, but if you have any suspicions, you have to be pretty cautious. And I'll tell you a true story that happened to us. We asked someone to carry a boxed phone to a different place by plane. Everything was just a regular phone. Everything was all right. The person was carrying got to security, and they said to them, whose is this? And they answered, I'm taking it for someone. So that was the beginning of a very bad situation. And they said to them, it came back to them and says, we've tested your bags, and we found traces of explosives. Right? Now, it was a bluff. There were no explosives. But it was the way of trying to entrap people that would they be doing something wrong, they would feel trapped and they wouldn't know what to answer, and however they expect you to respond to these kinds of accusations. You know, traces of explosives, just, you know, how many traces? Well, none really, but you know, just about, we've got some, but they can say what they like. And it was a young person being told, you are being used as a person carrying explosives on a plane, and Hashem, they were so naive and so innocent that they didn't have anything to say about it. And in the end they said, you know, you wasted our time and you're an idiot for carrying this for someone, but we're not gonna have nothing to charge you with, and you can go on your way. But very, very tense, and we felt terrible for having asked them to bring it. So we could have been machnit to them as for this man, and they could answer honestly, it's mine or I packed it or whatever they wanted to say. But again, who wants to be in that position where you've just told them it's yours, and then they tell you it's got traces of explosives? That's even worse. So be very careful with whatever you're taking. I'll finish with this because we're out of time. That is, a person has to realize that every time we step into the public eye, we have something to gain and something to lose. On one hand, if we act with derech eretz and respectable and whatever else, we don't have to be pushovers. We're allowed to say, hey, you didn't deliver what you were supposed to deliver for my money. You're allowed to say, make tainas and mum, and they goyim understand that, right? But mitzad sheni, you can do it with derech eretz, you can make a very, very beautiful kiddush Hashem. Mitzad sheni, we've all seen people, or at least I've seen people, who get carried away the other way, and it doesn't leave a very good taste in people's mouths. It's not just a bad taste about the individual, it can, chas shalom, leave a bad taste about Yiddishkeit. Yeah.